Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh LaHaz, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
And I'm Christine Van Gine, the CCF's litigation director.
And I'm Joanna Barron, executive director of the CCF.
In today's episode, we'll tell you why you should care that Niagara Region has declared an emergency over the impending eclipse. Ooh.
I'll walk you through the Supreme Court's new decision that finds that the Charter's guarantees must sometimes yield to Indigenous self-government rights, but that the Charter does apply to Indigenous governments.
And we'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some legal opinions that didn't quite land. But first, I'm going to tell you about a story out of Waterloo region in Ontario. And no, it's not about freedom of speech this time. So I'm talking about this apparent plan by Waterloo region to expropriate farmland for apparently industrial purposes without even telling the farmers what the land would be used for, and making offers that seem really low considering what the land is probably actually worth. And for those who don't know, expropriation is where the government takes title to your property, usually for like a public purpose, like building a road or building a big transit project. And they do compensate you for it. But my understanding, which is pretty limited, is that you don't have a lot of recourse in fighting back. And basically, you end up just arguing over how much compensation you should get. So here's what's happening in Waterloo. According to the Waterloo Record, the local newspaper, a consulting firm was hired by the region, and it went to half a dozen farmers, some of whom have been farming in that area, like their families, since the 1800s, and said, sell your land at $35,000 an acre in the next 10 days, or we're going to take it from you. We're going to expropriate it. And according to a local land developer, and this is where things get really interesting, he had offered to buy this land from the farmers at a much higher price back in February of this year. And the developer was saying that he had intended to buy this land because he had heard a rumor that there might be a Toyota plant built there. And if that was true, he could flip that land at a much higher price. You know, it would be worth potentially in the millions of dollars per acre. So according to the local MPP, her name's Catherine Fife, she says the land is 770 acres in total. So if the farmers had accepted the offer that was made to them in March, you know, you have 10 days to sell or we're taking it, they would have gotten something like $27 million out of it, which sounds not bad. But according to this local developer, if the land does get rezoned and was industrial land, it could have been worth in the billions of dollars.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, like I said, this is all sort of based on rumors because there's very few facts. And one of the reasons there's very few facts here is because, again, according to this local MPP, Catherine Fife, the regional councillors have all signed NDAs that they're not allowed to talk about what the expropriation is for. And, you know, therefore, we don't really know all that much. And there's a local organic farmer. She happens to live in the region. It's not one of her properties that is potentially being expropriated. But she says, like, she's never heard of this before. And she's asked around. And it seems to be very uncommon that a region would, you know, expropriate land just so that they can give it or sell it to a big, you know, multinational corporation, if that is in fact what's going on. And we don't really know what's going on because the region of Waterloo, like I said, they won't talk. So here's what they've said publicly, and this was in a quote to the local CBC station. They said, the region of Waterloo and Wilmot Township are partnering on land readiness to create shovel-ready sites to attract economic investments and create jobs. Land assembly is underway to create shovel-ready sites for large-scale economic investments to further support Waterloo's economic vitality as it grows to a million residents by 2050. And the province, area municipalities, local utility providers, and the Waterloo Region Economic Development Corporation will work to identify and plan for suitable mega sites to support new large-scale strategic employment uses that complement the regional economy. Now, you know, I don't want to pass judgment on whether it's like a good idea or a bad idea to build some giant Toyota plant here, if that is indeed what's happening. But I do think it's setting a really scary precedent if regions are going to start assembling land for future industrial purposes just by simply expropriating it. And we're talking about farmland here, which is already in pretty short supply. So I looked into expropriation law a little bit. Like I said, you know, this is obviously not legal advice and I don't know all that much about expropriation, but when you're compensated, you do get compensated for highest and best use. So, you know, if the land can be rezoned easily to something like industrial and that's worth a lot more, you should be compensated at that amount or so it would appear. But you don't get to take into account the project that the land is being rezoned for. So it wouldn't be like the huge amounts that would potentially be fetched if indeed there is going to be some big Toyota plant. So I don't know. My issue here is just if you care about property rights, it seems like kind of a scary thing that the government would come in and just try and take your land at very low, give you a very low price for it to build some giant factory, if that is indeed what's happening. So I thought we would talk about this a little bit and keep an eye on it. Joanna, what do you think of this story?
Well, it's hard to say because so much of it is based on rumors and speculation. Like, are these rumors credible? They sound like they should be credible, but they're just rumors. And we don't have particularly strong protections for property rights in Canada. We do have some protections for expropriation, which were strengthened by the Annapolis case, which we intervened in last year at the Supreme Court. But this whole thing sounds like it's like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. It's like the classic like evil government story of the government like lying to you, stealing your land or buying it super on the cheap and then installing an evil industrial plant. So I think we should just watch this. The narrative is certainly compelling. The injustice is palpable. So if it is true that the government is doing some type of shady second dealing and bait and switch on land that's worth like exponentially more, then it's extraordinarily unfair. What do you think, Christine?
So one of the things that it reminded me of is this movie from 1997 from Australia.
Oh, I don't know Castle. If you guys have it. I was thinking about that too.
It's so amazing. It's such really an amazing good. Movie. I recommend everyone who is interested in expropriation watch this movie because it really will help you understand. I mean, I think intuitively we all understand how upsetting it would be for the government to come in and take your home from you. And that's what they attempted to
do. Or your farm.
Or your farm, yeah. Well, a lot of people live on their farm property as well.
Right.
And in Australia, so this movie is set in Australia. It's about a man's home was trying to be expropriated by the government to build an airport. And it actually, you know, in Canada, we have legislation that governs expropriation. But in Australia, there's actually a section of the Constitution that protects property. It guarantees compensation or just terms for compensation for the acquisition of property that's being expropriated. So the movie simplifies a lot of the legal principles, but it's a really compelling story about expropriation. So I really encourage everyone to watch that if you've never seen it. Another thing that stood out to me is we know a lot of these car plants or car battery plants, the government comes in and makes big announcements that we're going to put this in here and they're giving, you know, billions in subsidies to these plants to attract them, which I don't think that we should do it from a policy perspective. And then they will just back out of it at the last minute. We've seen this again and again. So just imagine the double frustration if, I mean, this hasn't happened yet in this case, but imagine if, you know, your land is expropriated for this use, and then the company comes in, takes taxpayer money, and then kind of decides they're not going to do it after all. I mean, this is a story we've seen play out a number of times in Ontario in particular. So anyway, watch the movie. I really encourage you to watch it. It's excellent. And I also hate this kind of stuff. It's expropriation and subsidies for these big companies to come to Ontario and then bail at the last minute. But I'll move on to my news headline now. My news headline is about the eclipse and how Niagara region has declared a state of emergency because of tourists that they expect to come to Niagara because of it. And one of my favorite comments about the eclipse came from one of our one of the guys that works with CCF, Russ. He said that this reminds him of like primitive man living in a cave as a Neanderthal. And he's like, oh, this sun is angry. We must hide in our cave.
It's true. Eclipses are historically a very bad omen. That's why I am going outside of the path of totality. I will not even be near it. I don't want to be around it. It's dangerous.
So you relate to primitive man.
I do.
Well, I hope you don't relate to the regional chair of Niagara, who has declared an emergency as a result of the eclipse, and more about the tourists who they expect to come into the path of totality in Niagara. They declared the state of emergency 11 days before the eclipse because they say they expect a million people to come to the Falls region to watch the eclipse. And Josh and I, we've talked about this. It's very unclear where they got the number of 1 million. I mean, I think that the eclipse is cool. I will be watching it. But a million people, it's really weird where they got this. And we've tried to figure out where they slopped together this estimate. And basically what we think happened is that some American documentary film has said that 8 to 9 times the biggest Niagara Falls event is going to show up for the eclipse. And then the mayor of Niagara said that the biggest event ever was when one of the Willenda people did the crossing of the falls on a tightrope. And that was 150,000 spectators. So as far as we can tell, all the politicians did was multiply 150,000 by 8 or 9 to arrive at this estimate of a million. And that is just a ridiculous way to estimate the potential number of tourists. And look, if that many people show up, I will eat my words, but I do not think that they will. This is the middle of the day on a Monday. And yes, there is hype, but less hype than there is about, you know, New Year's Eve or Canada Day or other, you know, other annual events that are not emergencies. And even if the estimate is correct, tourists are not an emergency. If it was, all of those other annual events that I just listed, other community festivals, protests, those would all be emergencies too, and they're not. The emergency was actually declared in Niagara under a piece of provincial legislation called the Emergency Management Civil Protection Act. But in that legislation, an emergency is defined, and it's defined as a situation of or impending situation that constitutes a danger of major proportions that could result in serious harm to persons or substantial damage to property, and that is caused by the forces of nature, a disease, or other health risk, an accident, or act, whether intentional or otherwise. So tourism, just even a lot of tourists, just does not meet that threshold. And there's also a lot of misunderstanding about what declaring an emergency under the Emergency Management Civil Protection Act actually does. And a lot of people, including those who work for municipalities, and even the mayor of Niagara Falls, they seem to think that it unlocks federal and provincial funding. And they cite a specific part of the act for this claim. It's section 13.1 sub 2 and sub 4. But these provisions do not unlock funding. And actually, the regional chair of Niagara, in a memo from another performative emergency declaration in 2021, this one's over homelessness, he specifically said that the Emergency Management Civil Protection Act does not grant access to provincial funding. What those provisions do is they authorize the province or municipality to enter into mutual aid agreements to deal with an emergency, but there's a distinction in law between an emergency and a declared emergency under the Emergency Management Civil Protection Act. So if the point is to get extra funding through a declaration, it doesn't achieve that, and the region knows that. And they've actually said that in the past. And if the point is to deal with extra tourists, well, obviously there are ways to do that without declaring an emergency. Police can close roads under the Highway Traffic Act. Local municipal offices and services can be closed without declaring an emergency to the extent that they even need to be closed. The Emergency Operations Center for Niagara Falls or the region can be activated. An operations center is like a physical location where leaders of the municipality can gather to monitor large events and respond if necessary. They're often activated for large event monitoring, but it doesn't require a declaration. And if something does go haywire, if something crazy happens, like I don't know what they're imagining, but if something happens, first responders in Niagara can implement the regional or municipal emergency plan that they already have, and that doesn't require an emergency declaration either. So why this matters is that declaring an emergency, especially when the definition isn't met, could give the municipality access to broader powers than are actually necessary in a situation like this. And that results in government overreach, especially since we already know the social activists are going to declare emergencies over all kinds of social issues. And I mentioned that Niagara had previously declared an emergency over homelessness. We know that other municipalities like Kingston have declared emergencies, although not under this legislation, but they've declared it over climate change. And this all has consequences because the legislation comes with some real powers. Section 4.4(1) allows the head of council, which is the regional chair or the mayor, to take such actions and make such orders as are necessary and are not contrary to law. And, you know, there's some debate over what the scope of that means, but according to a emergency expert, emergency law and procedural parliamentary law expert, Lyle Skinner, who I've been talking to about this, he said that the legislation could be used to do things like impose a curfew or ration goods. So just imagine a city declaring a climate emergency and then using those powers to deal with the climate emergency. I don't like what I imagine in that scenario. So what should happen in this case? Well, since there is no emergency under the legislation, the premier has the power to and should rescind the declaration of emergency. And if Ford doesn't rescind this declaration, I think there's a big risk that he's going to be faced with regions and cities across the province declaring all kinds of things to be emergencies. You know, social issues or other mundane annual events are going to declare these are all emergencies. They're going to expect extra funding, which they're actually not entitled to, but demand it from the premier. And then they might impose restrictions to deal with these imagined emergencies as long as those restrictions are not contrary to law. So you're listening to this. What I'm encouraging people to do, since the eclipse hasn't happened yet, is there's still time to rescind this. So email the premier at premier@ontario.ca and tell him to rescind this. Joanna, what's your reaction? I know you're going to hide in your cave from the eclipse, but what do you think of it? Is it an emergency?
No, I think it's certainly not. And I think that this is a worrying trend. One of our biggest hopes in the wake of the Emergencies Act decision, obviously this is more small potatoes, less severe. I don't expect that the mayor of Niagara Falls is going to be freezing anybody's bank accounts without a warrant. But nonetheless, emergency powers, if there's one thing that we've learned in the last few years, is that there's one thing that it can open a Pandora's box of all manner of government overreach and abuses, it's the invocation of emergency powers. And it's whipping up fear. Maybe there is this like subconscious archetypal fear of like the bad omen of the dark eclipse that's being whipped up into this fear of like an onslaught of tourists and total mayhem. I think the particular measures of like closing down public services and daycares seem like exactly the opposite of what you want in circumstances where there's going to be an onslaught of people and a disruption to normal life. And so, yeah, I certainly, I agree. Email Doug Ford. He is somebody that likes to be liked, as you said, Christine, and he doesn't like to displease his constituents. So I think our best shot in this case is to email premier@ontario.ca and give him a piece of your mind. Tell him to rescind the Niagara Falls emergency. Josh, what do you think? What's your position on the eclipse? Good or bad?
I actually don't care all that much about the eclipse. I've got the glasses, so I'm ready to go. I don't understand why people like don't think back to childhood when they read the story about the boy who cried wolf, because that's what you do when you say things are emergencies that are not, is you desensitize people to the word emergency. And in the future, when there are real emergencies, people won't be willing to listen to you or do what you say if you really do need to sort of direct them as an executive, as a government. So I think this whole trend is really awful. I think back to the summer where Nova Scotia had some really horrendous forest fires that were very much an emergency in a small part of the province. And they invoked their Emergencies Act for the whole province, including areas where there was no fire risk at all. And they did things like say, you know, even though there's horrible fires in near Halifax, you can't go out into the woods and like canoe or camp or whatever in Cape Breton, even though there's like no fire risk there. So these things lead to bad consequences really fast in some cases. That harmed tourism severely, and this was right after COVID. So just one example that stands out. Another thing, like I really fully expect to hear people declaring emergencies for homelessness in the future if we don't sort of rein this in. And homelessness is a huge problem, but it's an intractable problem. It's not an emergency. And one of the things that happens in emergencies is often private property gets commandeered by the government. And I wouldn't be shocked, knowing the councillors that I know in the city of Toronto who are vary from sort of the left wing of the NDP to full on self-declared communists who want all housing to be public property. I wouldn't be surprised to see them say like, oh, hotels, you have to suddenly take in homeless people or something like that. And, you know, I just think this whole trend of declaring things emergencies that are not really emergencies needs to be stopped. And so even though you might say, you know, what's the big deal in this particular case, the big deal is that you're using the act to do something that you're not allowed to do it for. And so I'm really happy, Christine, that you're on top of this, that we're on top of this.
Yeah. One thing that's good is that in New Brunswick, the town of St. Stephen's declared an emergency over homelessness, which, as you say, is a real issue. It's a serious issue, but it does not meet the statutory definition. Social issues that are systemic and longstanding and that can't be resolved, you know, quickly don't constitute an emergency under this legislation. So in St. Stephen's in New Brunswick, the Minister of Public Safety did what we're asking Doug Ford to do. He rescinded the emergency and he said, you know, we understand why the town is concerned, but it does not meet the definition. You should not be declaring an emergency under this legislation. So that's what Doug Ford should do in this case. Anyway, let's go on to Joanna's headline. But first, let's take a break.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. Along with our new podcast, Not Reserving Judgment, it's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at thecccf.ca/freedomupdate.
Okay. So I'm going to try and be as snappy and tight with this as possible, because Josh, you told me to, although this case that I'm going to break down.
I was talking about Christine when I said that.
I don't know. I re-listened. I have a friend who's really into like digital rights and told me that he listened to the podcast where I broke down Bykovitz and the IP addresses. So I went back and listened. I was like, man, it was so long, because the decision itself was so long and complex. So I'm going to try and be as to the point as possible. But this,
yeah, we always give you the long, complex issues, and then I deal with eclipses.
Eclipses matter. Okay, so the decision that we're breaking down came out from the Supreme Court last week, Supreme Court of Canada. It's called Dixon versus Bunta-Gwich'in First Nations. And in this case, the SCC confirms that Indigenous governance bodies, including Indigenous governments that have their own constitutions, are bound by the fundamental protections of the Charter, and that the baseline protections of the Charter are in place for Indigenous persons. But there's a very big caveat, which I'll get into, at least if you read the majority. So CCF, we intervened in this case, and we argued that Section 25 of the Charter, which provides that no rights and freedoms of the Charter should be construed so as to abrogate or derogate from any Aboriginal treaty or other rights or freedoms that pertain to the Aboriginal peoples of Canada. That's from the text of the Charter. And we argued that Section 25, which I just read, is a guarantee to Indigenous peoples that the Charter will not be used as a sword by non-Indigenous peoples to undermine their specific collective and distinct rights. It recognizes that in addition to the rights entrenched in the Charter, like the right to equality, the right to free expression, Indigenous peoples also, because of their unique history, have other rights. And so this section protects them. So Section 25 can be conceived of it as a shield in part. However, and we'll get into why this factual scenario brought this issue up, Section 25 does not deprive an Indigenous person from making a charter claim as against an Indigenous government, or shield all decision-making of Indigenous governments from charter scrutiny. And we argued that if the SCC did not find this, it had the potential to create charter-free zones on settlement lands. This could obviously deprive Indigenous Canadians of the same basic protections that every other Canadian has, and that can't be an acceptable proposition. So getting to the case, in the result, the case settles what Section 25 means, and it confirms that Section 25 is not a shield. Self-governing Indigenous groups cannot just assert this to prevent any scrutiny of their policies or laws whenever they wish. But unfortunately, in the result of the applicant, Cindy Dixon, it can sometimes operate like a shield. So this is the complexity. So quickly, the background: Cindy Dixon is a member of the Bunta-Gwich'in First Nation. She wished to stand for election as a councillor on the settlement lands government. Because Ms. Dixon has a child with a medical condition, and I think also the child's father lives in Whitehorse, and the child needs access to a hospital, Dixon resides in Whitehorse rather than in Old Crow, which is Bunta's fly-in community on its settlement lands. This is in the north of the Yukon Territory. And the nation concluded a self-government treaty with the Yukon government in 1993. It has its own constitution, and included in that constitution is a rule which requires all council members to reside in Old Crow or relocate there within 2 weeks of being elected. Dixon asserted that this rule was a violation of her right to equality under Section 15.1 of the Charter, and the Indigenous government, the Bunta-Gwich'in First Nation government, responded that she was prevented even from asserting the Charter against its own internal rules. So in the result, a majority of the Supreme Court upheld the residency requirements for council positions. They said that this rule was irreconcilable with the Charter's equality guarantee because it pertained to Indigenous difference, and it pertained to a particular Indigenous conception of the importance of governance being rooted on having residency on the land. And before I get into their reasoning and quickly touching on the dissent, I should just emphasize that this is not an issue of how Section 25 of the Charter operates. This does not by any means attract unanimous consensus amongst Indigenous organizations. At the court hearings, some organizations urged the court to find that the Charter ought to be applied to Indigenous governments in general. And they pointed the need to safeguard the rights of vulnerable Indigenous persons. But all other Indigenous organizations argued that the Charter cannot apply to self-governing Indigenous nations unless that nation explicitly consents to it. So the majority, which was written by Kassir and Jamal J, found that the purpose of Section 25 is to protect what they call indigenous difference, which they break down as including cultural difference, prior occupancy, sovereignty, and treaty participation. And they conclude that where one of these collective rights is in a real, and the word they use is irreconcilable, conflict with individual charter rights, it can effectively trump those rights. And here, as they said this rule of residency to stand for council was one of those irreconcilable conflicts. However, the dissent, which was written by Justice Obonsuen, who is the court's only Indigenous member, as well as Justice Martin, also a woman, perhaps not by accident, disagreed. And they would have applied Section 25 more narrowly. They cited from the intervener factum of the CCF, and they emphasized the importance of ensuring that this shield and protection of Indigenous rights in Section 25 cannot effectively create extensive charter-free zones in the context of Indigenous self-government, depriving Indigenous people, and I'm quoting from the dissent, depriving Indigenous peoples of fundamental rights protections and immunizing governments from the rights and freedoms floor found in the charter. And so in the result, the dissenting judges, and there's another dissent written by Justice Malcolm Rowe that I'm not even going to comment on because I've gone on long enough. The dissent found that Cindy Dixon's right to equality was unjustifiably violated as a member of Vuntut Gwich'in, who, even though she did not reside on the traditional settlement lands, still retained her cultural identity as a member of the nation. And they found that Section 25 should not act as a shield to prevent Indigenous people from asserting their charter rights. They found that this was not really an irreconcilable conflict. So I have a piece about this in the Hub today where I speculate that this could be a bad precedent for Indigenous women. Josh, I'll call you out. You gave me some amazing edits on my piece for the Hub over the weekend. One thing I disagree with you, though, on, and maybe we can talk about this, is to me, this decision clearly is going to have a disproportionate effect on Indigenous women, who I do think are more likely to, in terms of residency requirements, who I think are more likely to either marry out and have to settle outside of settlement lands, or, like, I think Dixon is not an exceptional case, have to live off reservation for caretaking or family reasons. And this issue has come up before, the issue of Indigenous women, how they preserve their status, their, you know, protected status as being Indigenous when they marry non-Indigenous men. That was found to be discriminatory in a decision called Lovelace. Very complicated and substantive issues. But Josh, any thoughts on this case, which I know was extremely complicated, but also extremely consequential?
This case was like hundreds of pages, this decision. It took longer to come out than pretty much any other case that we've intervened in. And I guess that's because they had so much thinking and writing to do. And I gotta say, I didn't find either of the majority opinion or the opinion by Justice Obonsuen and Justice Martin all that convincing, even though they spent, you know, hundreds of pages trying to explain, like trying to interpret this section, this fairly short section of the charter, Section 25. To me, like the big question here is, are Indigenous people, when they're, do they have an inherent right to self-govern? And if so, does that exist because they were, you know, here in Canada before Canada became a country, and that they've retained that inherent right to self-government to some degree? And if so, does that mean in particular cases where they have like an Indigenous difference, like, for example, maybe they have a culture that says only women can be chiefs or only men can be chiefs, either one. Does Section 25 exist to, you know, preserve that difference? And I think you could read it that way. I think you could read it the way that Justice Obonsuen and Martin read it. And it's the decision doesn't provide all that much clarity. Let's just say that. So I'm glad to see that the charter applies, because I do think these are sort of universal rights that certainly should apply to everyone, but in terms of figuring out what Section 25 is really doing or supposed to do, I'm not even convinced after this huge long decision that we know that for sure. So I think the story of Section 25 is one that will continue going forward. Christine, I'm not sure if you even got a chance to read this decision yet, but do you have any thoughts on this? You obviously were involved at the intervention stage.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway is sort of what Joanna has put in her Hub headline. And it's exactly what you just said, Josh, that this doesn't actually give us that much clarity. And Joanna's headline is, Supreme Court confirms that the charter applies to Indigenous governments except when it doesn't. And the byline is that this is going to almost certainly be bad news for Indigenous women. And I agree with you about that, Joanna, just based on historical facts. So I also agree with you, Josh, that I don't think that the story is over on Section 25. And I think that our intervention, even though things didn't entirely go our way, I think it was extremely meaningful in this case. And I think that the majority was cognizant to this concept of charter-free zones. And obviously the dissent was highly interested in that issue, citing directly from our factum. So I'll just leave it there. We've already talked a lot about this case. Everyone should probably go and read Joanna's Hub piece. It takes a really complex issue and explains it very well. But I'll turn now to my bad legal take of the week, which is about a lawsuit brought by a group of Ontario school boards against social media platforms. So four school boards in Ontario, some very large ones actually, are including Peel and Toronto. They're taking some of the largest social media companies to court over their products, alleging that the platforms are designed in a way that they say has negatively rewired the way children think, behave, and learn. And they also say that it disrupts school and the way school and teachers operate. So they're suing Meta, Snapchat, and TikTok, claiming various forms of negligence, like general negligence, defective product design, negligent manufacturing, failure to warn, and public nuisance. I had a look at the statement of claim. Basically, their claim is that these apps are addictive, especially for kids, and that they disrupt the classroom, they take away teaching time, among other claims. And they claim for damages. It is insane the amount of damages they want. It's $4.5 billion in damages. And I will disclose that my kids go to some of these school boards, that I also went to law school with one of the lawyers in this case. I'm friends with him, although I haven't seen him in about 10 years. But I also think that social media, like, I don't want my kids using social media. They're young. But still, I think that this claim is ridiculous. The whole thing is a bad legal take. I will say I'm not a personal injury lawyer. It's a personal injury firm that brought this claim, but my expertise is not in that area. But I think on its face, the claim is crazy. And I've also talked to lawyers who do specialize in this area, because a lot of people are talking about this claim. And one of my friends, who's a partner at the law firm Castles Brock, who works in this area, she pointed out some of the really big flaws. She said it's going to be difficult to establish that social media companies owe the school boards or the students a duty of care. And without a duty of care, there's no claim. She said there's no privity of contract between the school boards and these social media platforms. She said that quantifying damages, like lost teaching time, that's going to be almost impossible to quantify. And she said that if she was representing the social media platforms, what she would do is move to strike right away. And the premier, the premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, he gets a lot of things wrong. He has said that this lawsuit is nonsense, and I agree with him. Basically, I do think that social media is a problem for school-age kids. They can become really obsessed with it, and it makes them anxious. And, I don't think it's great, but this is something that parents should monitor, that they should take care to ensure that their kids are using social media in a responsible way, or perhaps not at all. And they should monitor how their kids use their phones and devices. And schools and school boards should enforce rules about using devices during class time. Enforce those policies. Don't blame social media companies for teachers not wanting to enforce the existing rules. It's just ridiculous to bring this lawsuit. It's a waste of everyone's time. It's a waste of the court's time. It's a waste of these platforms' time and money. And frankly, I think it's an attempt to force some type of money, of settlement, and get money out of the deep pockets of these platforms. I don't like it. I think the whole claim is a bad legal take. Joanna, what's your bad legal take of the week?
Okay, my bad legal take goes to Professor Bruce Ryder, who I normally have a lot of time for. And this is in response to some of the protests and other various mischief that took place over last weekend in Toronto, pro-Palestine protests. His tweet says, "The only criminal acts I could see on the videos were police officers assaulting protesters, exercising their right to peaceful assembly. Shameful conduct by Toronto police. Need some accountability." So I looked into what actually happened because I was actually surprised to see that several arrests were made in Toronto. And the TPS put out a statement where, first of all, there was a man at one of the protests who was operating a truck with people in the bed of the truck, presumably unsecured while it was in motion. So this person was charged with stunt driving. There's also an allegation that a woman threw horse manure at officers and another individual assaulted a peace officer with a weapon. So these are not protected activities. There have been hundreds of these protests, and for the most part, the police have taken a de-escalation, hands-off approach, despite the fact that there have been numerous violent calls for jihad. The rallying cry has been from the river to the sea, which eschews a desire, arguably, to wipe Israel and the only Jewish state off the map. And again, there have even been instances of police bringing Tim Hortons coffees to these protesters. There's no evidence that police have been anything less than respectful of the right to free assembly. And there's been some other hyperbole about the arrest that happened. A woman named Gada Sasa alleges on Twitter that the Toronto police tried to kill Palestinians in broad daylight. There's certainly no evidence of that. And look, so if you fling horse dung at a cop, or there was even a video I saw where a group of men tried to intimidate a female officer as the crowd shouted F B word and F pigs. There's a great memed shot of that officer just like keeping cool, keeping a heart rate of like 62 and just glowering silently while she's being called a bitch and a pig. So no, there's nothing inappropriate with police exercising their discretion to make arrests where clear illicit acts like this occur. Josh, what's your BLT?
Yeah, my bad legal take goes to Andrew McDougall, who is a former communications director for Stephen Harper, and he's written an op-ed in the Calgary Herald. I often agree with his op-eds, but this is not one of them. It's actually one of the worst op-eds on the Online Harms Act that I've seen so far. And the Online Harms Act, which our listeners already probably know, is the new bill from the Trudeau government that would aim to crack down on so-called harmful speech, like discriminatory speech or online bullying, by doing a few things: creating a digital safety commission that would oversee a new duty of responsibility for social media platforms, which would, you know, pressure them to take down more speech. It would change hate speech laws to introduce things like, you know, peace bonds for potentially saying hateful speech in the future. And it would bring back the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal's process whereby people can win compensation from their fellow Canadians if they say mean things to them online that rise to the standard of so-called discriminatory speech. And McDougall starts off well in his op-ed because he says, you know, no government should be defining or moderating speech, and that's what the Online Harms Act does. You know, so far so good, I agree with that. But then he says the real solution to online harms, like hateful speech, is, quote, hobbling the advertising algorithms and anonymity that lead to online abuse. And McDougall makes the point that social media algorithms that do lead to some online abuse are sort of designed to maximize engagement by tapping into things like anger or fear. And, you know, that's what gets clicks, and that's therefore what gets more advertisements served. And, you know, therefore, in his view, they've, you know, baked these online harms into their source code, and that needs to be addressed through big government regulation. And, you know, there's some truth to this. Like, social media does reward what Christine's dear friend Supriya Dwivedi would call rage farming, but that's not unique to social media. I remember when I was like a young editor at Maclean's, I realized very quickly that you want to have headlines that push people's emotional buttons, because that's what gets people to read your work, whether you're looking to profit off of it or just have people engage with it in any way. It's basically just human nature. And McDougall says that social media companies should either be forced to, quote, charge a monthly fee to users so that they don't have to rely on advertisers, or be taxed up the wazoo. So basically he's saying that speech is like, needs to be taxed like a sin tax. And that's crazy, because for all the rage that does happen on Twitter and Facebook, it's also made information way more accessible to people. It's given the masses the tools to express themselves and speak out on policy issues. And before that, it was just sort of elite journalists who got to speak in public about most issues. So, I can't agree with that. And then the take gets really bad, where he says that social media companies should be treated like publishers and have the legal consequences that come with that, you know, things like defamation or whatever. But that's just such a bad legal take, because, you know, a social media company is a publisher in the sense that they curate tweets through their algorithms, and they do take down content, and they do sort of shape the conversation. But individual tweets, they're not publishers of that. And if they are publishers, you know, they have speech rights of their own. And if there's publishers in regards to every single tweet, well, like, they can't be legally responsible for all of those. That would just be impossible. There are like millions of tweets per day. So that idea is just a non-starter too. And, you know, his last proposal is that people should be required to use their real names on social media accounts. And I have some sort of agreement with that idea, but I also really worry about things like Chinese social credit, where if you say the wrong thing online and it's linked to your driver's license, then you're going to be, you know, cut out from society, or you're going to have your bank accounts frozen more easily in the future. And so I think keeping on anonymity online is probably a good idea. So, you know, I'm glad that people are willing to talk about and debate the Online Harms Act, but this is a very bad legal take from Mr. McDougall. So I think that's it. I think that's the end of the show. And so, as usual, we hope you'll rate us, review us, and subscribe. And just a reminder that you can support our work by subscribing to the CCF's YouTube channel, now with video of our podcasts, by following us on Twitter, and by visiting the CCF's website, where you can sign up for our new and improved Freedom Update newsletter from our colleague Russ. The Canadian Constitution Foundation is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by your donations, so please click the donate button on our website if you can. Thanks for listening.